Chapter 33 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legimus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 33. After our marriage, the next few years were uneventful. Our son was born in a house in Chelsea. We went abroad to Corsica and the Riviera, then back to London, and then to Wiltshire, to a beautiful farmhouse called Lake Farm. We owed Lake Farm to my cousin, then Mrs. Edward Tennant, later Lady Glenconner, and now Lady Grey of Falardon. At that time she and I were friends, and had been so from childhood. It was she that pointed out to me the beauties of Lake Farm, which was half a mile from her house, Wilsford, and arranged with our landlord, dear old Mr. Lovibond, who occupied the beautiful old Elizabethan lake house, that I would be a suitable tenant for his farmhouse. Lake Farm was on the lovely road that runs between Amesbury and Salisbury. It was only about 100 yards from the River Avon, one of the best trout streams in England. During the time I was there, about 2 years, I had the run not only of Mr. Lovibond's water, but of that, extending over several miles, of our neighbours at Amesbury Abbey, Sir Edmund Antrobus, Strobus, and Lady Antrobus, Wavy. Farther down the river I also had leave to fish in the water of Mr. Devenish, and sometimes in that of Mr. Louis Greville, uncle of the late Lord Warwick, so I had miles of the finest trout fishing in England for nothing, and I became a fairly skilful dry-fly fisherman. I must put it on record that I was taught to fish by my father-in-law, Colonel Custance, at Weston, where he had a splendid trout stream. He was a magnificent fisherman. Up to the time of my marriage I had never fished at all, but I ended by loving it quite as much as shooting. I believe I caught one day, with dry fly, the second largest basket of trout ever secured on the Amesbury Abbey water. As far as I remember, and it could of course be verified in the trout book kept at the Abbey, I got 18 fish, all over 1.5 pounds, 11 of them over 2 pounds, and one of 3 pounds. In addition to that, I put back quite a dozen just under 1.5 pounds, the rule of the water being that you kept only fish over 1.5 pounds. The record basket was made the same year a few days before by Mr. Payne Galway. While we were at Lake, the Tennants, afterwards Glenconners, were, with Mr. Lovibond, our nearest neighbours, and showed us much kindness. But our great friends were the entirely delightful Strobus, who had formerly commanded the Grenadier Guards, and the equally delightful, if eccentric, Wavy. Their constant kindness and hospitality contributed largely to make our stay at Lake about the happiest period of our married life. It is tragic to think that both Strobus and Wavy are dead, and that their only child, Tuts, Grenadier Guards, was killed in the war. The present owner of the Abbey, which, by the way, was built by my collateral ancestor, the Duke of Queensbury, who resided there with Kitty, Duchess of Queensbury, celebrated for her patronage of the poet Gay, who wrote the Beggar's Opera at Amesbury Abbey, and for her aristocratic insolence to George III, is Sir Cosmo, brother of the late Sir Edmund. But I believe he does not live there, and the magnificent Palladian house stands empty. It was while I was at Lake, in 1907, that my cousin Pamela Tennant, Lady Grey of Falardon, induced her husband, Eddie Tennant, afterwards Lord Glenconner, to buy the Academy and to make me its editor. It is very difficult to write on this subject. My cousin Pamela, to whom I had always been devoted, is too well known both for her beauty and her talents, she is a considerable poet, to make it necessary for me to say anything about her from those points of view. Any feeble tribute that I could make to her would be completely drowned and overwhelmed in the constant flood of appreciation and adulation that has followed her from her earliest youth down to the present day. All I need say is that she was very kind to me, and that her action in getting me the editorship of the Academy was a piece of pure good nature and friendliness, which I have never ceased to appreciate and be grateful for. But the unfortunate truth must be told that while the general consensus of opinion, I think I may say without much fear of contradiction, puts my editorship of the Academy on record as synonymous with the palmy days of that journal, which rapidly declined and died after I was pushed out of the editorship, Pamela and I were never able to see eye to eye about it. From the moment I started editing it, there was constant friction and trouble. Whatever I did, I never seemed able to please the proprietor of the paper and his wife. I was constantly being found fault with, and whatever success the paper achieved while it still belonged to the tenants was in the teeth of much opposition and detraction from this quarter. Part of the trouble was no doubt due to the fact that I was a strong conservative of the die-hard variety, and that Eddie Tennant, Mr. Asquith's brother-in-law, was a Liberal and MP for Salisbury. At the same time, I must say that my running of the paper in the Conservative interest, and in the strongest opposition to Messrs. Asquith, Lloyd George, and Winston Churchill, whom I regarded then, and regard still more now, as jointly responsible for the ruin of the country and the smash-up of almost everything that used to make life in England worth living, was not carried on in opposition to the wishes of the man who was finding the money to run the paper and to pay my salary, £300 a year, which barely paid my out-of-pocket expenses, and which was less than half what might have been considered a fair salary for what I was doing. Some member of my own family said to me one day that it appeared to be rather rough on Eddie Tennant that I should be using his paper and his money to attack his party and his brother-in-law. This caused me to have qualms about the matter, and I wrote to him and told him what had been said, and asked if he objected to the political line of the paper. "If so," I said, "I will drop it. I cannot, of course, change my views or those of the paper, but if you wish it, I will drop politics altogether and stick to literature alone." Eddie wrote back at once and said, in effect, "Not at all. I don't mind it a bit. In fact, I think it very lively, and a great deal of what you say I entirely agree with." Much relieved at the receipt of this letter, I went ahead, and about 2 weeks later I wrote a very strongly worded attack on Mr. Asquith for his suppression, at the last minute, of the procession which had been arranged to celebrate the Catholic Eucharistic Congress. Incidentally, I must mention that during the whole time I controlled the Academy, I ran it as a High Church Anglican paper. I did not become a Catholic till the year after I lost the editorship. To my great surprise and indignation, I received what I can only describe as an extremely offensive letter from Eddie Tennant. He afterwards admitted that it was offensive, and withdrew and apologised for it. He told me that he considered that my article on Mr. Asquith was in the worst possible taste, and he went on to say, for about the third, and as it turned out, the last time, that he had definitely decided to sell the paper and cut all connection with it. I felt very indignant at this treatment, and the idea of losing the paper, of which I had then held the editorship for only about 8 or 9 months, was utter misery to me. It seemed to me a cruel thing, and yet entirely characteristic of the casual want of consideration of the very rich man in regards to the feelings and rights of the mere man of letters, who had happened to be his wife's cousin, and, according to her own oft-repeated account, one of the foremost poets of his age. At that time, Crossland had come on to the paper as my assistant editor, and he laughed at my fears of losing the paper. He put into my head an idea which would certainly never have occurred to me in my wildest dreams, the idea, namely, that I was not just the poor dependent on the half-contemptuous whim of the millionaire nouveau riche who paid my miserable little salary, but the editor of a powerful paper installed in a position from which, if I showed fight, it would be no easy job to oust me. Primed by Crossland, I took up the attitude, which I am bound to say I consider was entirely justified, that Eddie Tennant had no earthly right to make me editor of a paper on the tacit understanding of continuity, and then, just as I was beginning to get hold of my job and to understand what I could do, and just as I was involved in half a dozen controversies which covered matters of principle and the welfare of letters, as opposed to log-rolling and corrupt cliques, to whip round on me and tell me that he was going to sell the paper to my enemies and push me out into the cold. Even as a matter of bare legal right, I was, as an editor, entitled to 6 months' notice, but not a word about any such thing had been said, nor any suggestion that it was recognised that I had any rights at all in the matter. I do not suppose that Eddie Tennant had any idea that he was behaving in an arbitrary and ungenerous manner. He was, in matters of business, largely under the influence of his homme d'affaires, who had always greatly disapproved of the Academy and the, to him, utterly unprofitable expense it involved. All he wanted was to get out as quickly as possible from a responsibility which he ought never to have assumed, and which he was constitutionally incapable of shouldering with any degree of credit and dignity. Crossland told me that if I attempted to conduct the negotiations, I wouldn't have a dog's chance with these people, and that the only thing for me to do was to give him authority to go to Tennant and make the best terms he could for me. I told Crossland to go ahead. Crossland's methods were never very pleasant or amiable. He adopted a bullying and aggressive tone, which, I believe, was quite unnecessary. I believe now that if I had seen Eddie myself and told him exactly what my side of the case was, he would have seen it, and that he would have done what he actually did, without any necessity for all the rough stuff that Crossland imported into it. On the other hand, if it had not been for Crossland in the first crisis, I would have been simply squashed out of existence and my paper taken away from me, for it would never have occurred to my simple mind that I had any possible chance of vindicating my helpless right against Tennant and his homme d'affaires. To cut a long story short, Eddie ended by handing over the paper, for which he had paid £2,000, to me, together with a sum of £500, for which I gave him a bill, which I am bound to say I never had the slightest intention of taking up. If he had done all this of his own accord, it would have been generous, and an act of grace. As it was, he was more or less forced into it. The gift of the paper was not really so generous as it appears, for it was, at that time, running at a loss of at least £2,000 or £3,000 a year, and as a condition of keeping it going, I had to find this money myself, as soon as the £500, which lasted about 3 months, was exhausted. I feel pretty certain that Eddie himself and Mr. Asquith, who was in the offing, so to speak, did not give me 6 months of life for my paper. Eddie wanted a peerage, and, putting two and two together, it is not difficult to guess that Mr. Asquith was not going to give him one as long as he was supplying his wife's cousin with the money to run a paper which was a constant source of annoyance and a very real menace, as any well-written and sincere paper must be to those whom it opposes, to himself and all his most cherished schemes. As it happened, I ran the paper for more than 2 years after this date, and Eddie Tennant did not get his peerage till after I had sold it, through the intermediary of Pamela's brother, my cousin, George Wyndham, to Lord Fitzwilliam and Lord Howard de Walden. Altogether I edited the Academy for rather more than 3 years. In that time I doubled its price and more than trebled its circulation. At the end I sold it for £2,000. But I lost heavily over the whole transaction. To keep it going I raised money on a reversionary interest I had in my mother's property, and altogether, by the time I got rid of it, I was quite £2,000 out of pocket. It has always seemed to me a scandalous and a discreditable thing that there was not one solitary rich man in the country who would back me. If I had had anything like a decent backing, I would easily have turned the corner and made the paper pay a good profit. But, as things were, I kept it going only by great sacrifices and a succession of miracles. The only person who helped me was Lord Howard de Walden, who put up £2,000 in return for quite worthless debentures. When I sold the paper, he surrendered these debentures, as I did mine, representing the money I had sunk. But whereas what I lost represented nearly all that was left of my small fortune, I do not suppose that his loss of £2,000 worried Lord Howard de Walden. Had he continued me as editor when he and Lord Fitzwilliam bought the paper, I would, with the financial support which he then gave it, have easily made the paper into a paying proposition. It was already, when I had it, a powerful and influential paper and a great success d'estime. But he handed the editorship to a Mr. Cowper, who was utterly without experience in journalism or letters. I believe he was by profession a land agent, and who killed the paper. The moment I left the editorship, the circulation dropped to about half the figure up to which I had gradually worked it, and in a few years it was so depreciated and discredited that it was offered to me by then-proprietors for £25. I declined the offer, and it then expired, after an existence of nearly 50 years. End of chapter 33.